Ray Hellander, the chief accountant, drops the bomb. McDonald's ditched your Happy Meal toy. I am stunned by this fast food treason. Who's going to fight evil, I ask them. We've got a group in Bangalore. You don't have to speak English to fight evil. They offer a paltry retirement package, but I'm not going without a fight. I search my mind for an appropriate comeback. Freedom ain't cheap. In my case, it's $4.3 million a year.
Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Lynn Neary. Growing up on Long Island, G. Xavier Robillard loved to read comics. Now he's turned that obsession into a book, Captain Freedom, a superhero's quest for truth, justice, and the celebrity he so richly deserves. Robillard, a humor writer and satirist best known for his award-winning website All Day Coffee, is also a regular contributor to McSweeney's and Comedy Central. As the book begins, Captain Freedom is suffering from an identity crisis. He's lost his job at Gotham Comics and is searching for a new purpose in life, a quest that gives Robillard the chance to skewer our culture of celebrity and the very idea of superheroes. During a reading and discussion of the book taped at McNally Jackson Books on February 23rd, Robillard was joined by his editor, Carl Leonards.
First of all, thank you all for coming, and I'd like to thank McNally Jackson Books for having us tonight. This is really great. I'm going to start out, I'm just going to read a chapter, the second chapter of the book. All you need to know is that our hero's name, his real name is Sadiq Friedman, and he is a screenwriter. Over and over, I ask myself why I'm thrown out of the game, given the red card of life. Who is responsible? The supervillain masterminds, whom I've thrown into jail repeatedly? The international crime syndicate, Interbad, traitors within our own government? No, it's upper management. Instead of going to college, I studied with a Korean master to learn several ancient and useless forms of combat. And when I turned 20, with the help of my mother's expert machinations, I joined Gotham Comics. I gave them my heart and soul and my four superpowers: flying, lightning-fast reflexes, supernatural strength, and the uncanny ability to predict the weather. People always ask, if you're so good with the weather, why didn't you become a meteorologist? It's a typical reaction, like when you ask really tall people if they play basketball. But not even my understanding of the difference between sleet and freezing rain can prepare me for the treachery I'm about to experience. I'm in New York, teaching inner-city school children about the value of flossing, when I get a call from the accounting department at Gotham Comics. I fly up to their midtown offices right away. Entering the conference room, I'm immediately suspicious. They have a PowerPoint presentation. First, they remind me that my insurance premiums are too high, but I've put a generation of criminals behind bars. Then they start hurling financial mumbo-jumbo like Zeus's lightning bolts. Sales of your comic book are in decline. The market favors graphic novels about losers. We've posted losses for the last 7 quarters. We can't compete with the indecipherable but adorable manga. But what about the children, I ask? I taught so many of them valuable life lessons, like how to increase self-esteem by purchasing Captain Freedom products. Ray Hellander, the chief accountant, drops the bomb. McDonald's ditched your Happy Meal toy. I am stunned by this fast food treason. Who's going to fight evil, I ask them. We've got a group in Bangalore. You don't have to speak English to fight evil. They offer a paltry retirement package, but I'm not going without a fight. I search my mind for an appropriate comeback. Freedom ain't cheap. In my case, it's $4.3 million a year. Hellander brandishes a covered platter that was hidden under the table. You know what this is? I admit ignorance. He opens the lid. Tofu. Just a single block, medium firm, provenance unknown. Perhaps Chinese, perhaps not. There's no doubt he knows soy is my weakness. If I ingest it, I lose all of my superpowers. Quite a miraculous food, tofu. Adopts the flavor in which it's marinated. Fries quickly, high in protein, if you eat it with rice, he cautions. I smile. How is a group of accountants going to force me to eat that? You already have, Captain. A bead of perspiration abandons ship from the dry dock of my forehead. Your non-fat chai latte, this morning at the Hero's Commissary. What about it? It was made with soy milk. I try to use one of my powers, but I won't be able to use any of them for the next 72 hours. The froth on my morning beverage had seemed a little lacking in exuberance, but I imagined this was a telltale sign of skim milk. A door opens and in rushes a platoon of super attorneys. I'm surrounded. My power's useless. I stall. You really think you can force me into retirement? He waves a legal document in front of me. You're going to volunteer. It was the right incentive package. Freedom, you have no choice. Desperate, I remind Hellander that a large sell-off of Gotham Comics stock could trigger a panic in the market. The attorneys back off, and we negotiate. I don't get a gold watch, but now I have a golden parachute. According to our agreement, nobody can know that this happened. I volunteer to leave behind the life of fighting crime. They give me 45 minutes to leave the building. I have to clean out my corner office, but leave the laptop. There's no time to grab the Dilbert cartoons from my wall. They take away my secret decoder ring, my autographed copy of the Flash Gordon Hero Handbook, and the keys to the Freedom utility vehicle. I grab the promotional poster from the Captain Freedom movie. When it's time to go, security, some of my best superhero friends, escorts me out of the building. I've never even used this office. Gotham put it here for tourists visiting the building. So right now, some hack is clearing out my real office in L.A. I'm being simulcanned. I'm angry enough to toss a car across the street, but I'm not warmed up, and that's just begging for a back injury. I pass some guys working in a manhole in the middle of traffic, and I realize that life is not that bad. I've got a massive secret headquarters that's already been paid for. I can travel the world. Tibet! Never been there. Heard they have some great mountains. And they're languishing under the evil rule of the Chinese. Maybe all free Tibet. When you say that, you sound like a celebrity has-been, embracing fashionable causes like a hip-hop MC grabs his crotch. But I don't know what to do with my life. Being a superhero is the only job I've had since high school. Now I have to do something else? Life has prepared me for this one thing, to do good and to break the record for the number of bank robberies foiled. After I leave the Gotham Comics office, Cher, I know a lot of people in the entertainment business, is kind enough to let me crash at her place. And I remain in New York for a week to do a quick job search. I apply to work at the State Department, but they say I need to know Arabic. Then I apply at the Defense Department, and this time I tell them I know Arabic. They deny me the job. If I know Arabic, I must be a terrorist. Mom calls and leaves an epic message to tell me she's sorry I resigned, she's sure it's somehow my fault, and got me an interview with Occidental Comics. But I can't work with the OC. Their production values are low, their books aren't bound well, famous artists won't go near them. I might as well sign up for a cartoon newspaper strip. After 15 years on the side of good, maybe it's time I bat for the other team. I have plenty of contacts, and how hard can it be to become a supervillain? But I can't go evil. It would really disappoint the kids. Plus, I would be at risk of losing my $4 million settlement. The story that I've left Gotham gets out, and I schedule a press conference to discuss my future. The press is unkind. They interrupt and ask leading questions. Not a single person asks for my autograph. I'll never do that again, I say to nobody in particular, after I remove my microphone. Sure you will, says a chipper voice. It's Skip Goodwin, the plucky reporter, with a boyish charm, who I'm certain is somehow responsible for my downfall. You won't have a choice, he grins, if you want to stay in the public eye. And I know you do. Because of national security, the media are barred from covering heroes under contract unfavorably. But now it's open season. No matter how discreet I try to be, the paparazzi are there, taking humiliating photos of me falling down drunk in public or dancing on tables at the local bar. It's like they've singled me out because I'm famous. I'm ready to fly home to LA, but something stops me. Evil is still lurking. And there are several superheroes in the New York area who owe me money or who have borrowed CDs I'd really like to get back. My sources tell me that the villainous Wayne of Mass Destruction has engineered the Ronald Reagan, a mind-control device that could enslave New York. I must respond, even if I'm sans a Happy Meal contract. Using Google, I quickly find Wayne's lab. He's surprised to see me. Captain Freedom, he snarls. I thought you retired. He's pointing the ray gun at me. I am, but I still hate evil. Surrender the weapon. I give him the calm, trusting look of a friend who would never put him back in jail. Wayne throws down a smoke pellet. By the time the air clears and I get visine in my eyes, he and the weapon are gone. I rush outside to see he's high in the air. I will never understand why criminals are allowed to buy jetpacks. Jetpacks were nationalized in 1986 after heavy lobbying by the National Rocket Association. I launch into the sky and catch up with him. You can't fight me, he sneers. You don't have insurance anymore. I've got Cobra. He hurls his homemade explosives at me, but I dodge them with ease. I've got a heat-seeking missile, Freedom, straight from my friends in North Korea. You'll never escape. Little does he know. We enter a region of high barometric pressure, which stalls his jetpack engine. WMD is tilted off balance, and crack! I knock him unconscious. I pry the ray gun from his clutches. It'll be a great addition to my exotic weapons collection. Spectators cheer as we land, and for once, I've saved the city without destroying real estate. I may be retired, but the Captain Freedom Happy Meal will return. Right? Thank you.
So we've not rehearsed this. We're not exactly sure how it's going to go. I'd rather ask questions I don't know the answers to, but I will throw you some softballs.
All right.
Now, when you read the book, which I know you all will, I made a note of four acronyms that, by the way, you laughed on all the right lines.
You're a good audience, thank you.
But you actually missed four of them. And it was the acronyms, which you have to read them, I think, to see. I can't work with the OC. I just love that. The Freedom Utility Vehicle, or is it the Fighting Utility Vehicle?
It's the Freedom, it's the FUV.
The FUV. No laugh. The National Rocket Association, I fell off, the NRA, I fell off my chair.
That is my single, I have to say, my single favorite footnote in the book, and for some reason, I wanted it to be something like the NRA, and I was stuck with the word jetpack, and for the life of me, couldn't think of something that started with R that had anything to do with it. I actually had to go to a thesaurus. Oh, rocket. Yeah. The hard life of a writer.
Yep. And Wayne of Mass Destruction, WMD. So those are, as you read these things, and the footnotes especially are also wonderful, visual nuggets at the bottom of the page. You're a genius. As you wrote this novel, you write your essays, your comic pieces, and the timing part of it. Is it like a little ticker in your head, like every third sentence you need like a little funny thing, or do you want to just let it flow?
It's mostly a flow thing. I don't have any sort of... It just seems like they're good spots for jokes. And then sometimes the thing that's harder is when you have, I think we have a really good joke that you just have to kill because it's interrupting and it's showing off. And those are the ones you have to get rid of.
Did you keep those somewhere?
Yeah, there's a file. You know, I learned this once from a fiction teacher that you have a file of your favorite lines that clutter your fiction that you just put somewhere and keep.
Good. We'll do that next.
Yeah.
The outtakes?
The outtakes. It's for the box set CD.
Anything that I took out of the book that you were still mad at me about?
Can I bring up the Michael Craig thing?
No.
Okay.
We'll do the other one, though.
We'll do what was the other?
The Ronald Reagan was the Rupert Reagan.
Yeah, it was the... It was
and sad. I said, I'm sorry, man, I can't... No.
Yeah.
No. And then there was the legal read. Remember the legal read?
The legal read was fabulous.
There were about seven or eight things they wanted us to think about. And there's a scene where Jeannie Garofalo is getting drunk at a bar, and the lawyer said, has the author seen this personally?
I did. They didn't ask me that.
Oh, really?
I have. I write what I know.
And you call the Portland Trailblazers the
Jailblazers. They've always been called the Jail. I lived in Portland for a long time, and they're the Jailblazers. But the response from the legal team was great because they said, we did a Google search. I was like, wait, that's your job? You're an attorney for HarperCollins, and you use Google? And so there was like, well, there's 70,000 instances that showed up immediately of the Trailblazers being called the Jailblazers. So
what else is that? Do you remember? Those are the two that stood out
to me.
The
big ones.
We use Wikipedia now, not Google.
That's a bad idea.
I know.
Stop.
Do you have the Captain Freedom site?
Yes. CaptainFreedom.net. It's a blog that I've been trying to maintain on a daily basis and failing because I've been on the road for the... long weekend now, and I'm going to start to pick it up again. And I'm blogging at powells.com this week, so I've just been sort of cross-linking between those two.
And Captain Freedom's upset about the publication of this book. So the first video is, what are you wearing in that?
I'm wearing a ski outfit.
Oh, yeah.
Just random ski clothes.
And you listen to your voice.
Yeah.
So there's no face. It's Captain Freedom mad about the book, but it looked like pajamas also.
Yeah, they're like your they're black tights. They were okay. Yeah, black ski tights.
Okay, good.
Or pajamas.
Some of my favorite Lufa, the bad guy, the bad people. There's Lufa.
Yeah.
Who else? Who's Les Miserables?
Well, there's the three members. So it's the French triumvirate of terror. There's Enfant Terrible, Montesquieu, and I don't think I ever named the third one.
Good. That's good. Yeah. And Lufa was on his own. Lufa
was on his own. And that was, in fact, I knew that this was going to be a productive relationship because the very first time you called me, I picked up the phone and you said, it's Lufa.
Oh.
Wow.
Oh, it is?
This guy's hardcore.
Yeah. It's a little shower thing, right?
It is. Okay. It was a reference to Bill O'Reilly, a very veiled reference to Bill O'Reilly.
I did not.
It's okay.
Thanks for slipping that in. That's great. Does everybody know what the inspiration for the book, where the whole thing began?
Tell them. Sure.
Men. What? Good. All right. Have we met before? No, we've not. Okay. So.
I owe an enormous debt of gratitude to the state of California for electing Arnold Schwarzenegger as their governor. In 2003, when he was right about to have his inaugural address, I wrote a piece, which was the first piece I ever got published on McSweeney's, and it was Inaugural Speeches of Our Action Heroes. And it was various things from my childhood, Optimus Prime and He-Man and things like that, that half of you will not know. And so I did that, and it was actually it worked really well as a piece for them. And then a year later, I was asked to do a skit on the radio for the local NPR station in Portland. And I just had nothing. Like, I had just no material whatsoever. And as a humor writer, I find it's always good to go dip back into the same stream. And I really like this idea of this political superhero character, but as I thought about it, the piece, I decided to go back in time and see, well, what caused him to hang up the mask and the cape and to go into politics? And then I realized the book had to start, or the story I was doing for NPR had to start when he's getting fired. And that's what I read was an edited but longer version than what's on NPR. And then it just kind of snowballed from there.
And then in the book, he goes back to high school, which is a great school on the hill, which is great. And then in the middle of the book, we pick up. That was at first when I was reading it.
It was stupid. It was like a stupid Borgesian time shift that made no sense, but I was adamant about keeping.
But it worked. Right in the middle, we pick up the present time, and then we move ahead where he writes a children's book. And what happens with that when he...
accidentally outs another superhero.
Like some sort of cavity fighter or something.
Yeah.
And then...
And that was the one we had to use. I really wanted to somehow use Valerie Plame's name in that, and I just figured I couldn't. Then I ended up inadvertently naming the character after a congresswoman from New Mexico.
Did you really?
Yeah, and we had to take that out too. I have no idea at this point what her name was.
And as you're writing, things were happening with, obviously, the war in Iraq, and also when Tom... this crazy senator, congressman from DeLay.
Yes, Tom DeLay.
All the senators from Texas left, so they couldn't vote.
They fled the state. They all went to Oklahoma, and they holed up in a hotel somewhere.
When Captain Freedom becomes governor of California, they all leave and go to a whorehouse in Reno.
Yeah.
And he has to go bring them back, and it's just very, very topical, very funny stuff. Anything you would add now that you thought you would...
There's a lot of that kind of. When I was in Salem recently, reading to the town apparently has five people because that's as many people were there.
The witches.
It was witches night off.
It
was Friday the 13th.
Was
it? Was. Yeah. And so I didn't get burned at the stake, so I thought that was a great accomplishment. But I realized as I was preparing, I've been doing different chapters every night, and I realized I have nothing essentially supernatural. There's no zombies. No witches. I didn't really want to go too heavily on the Harry Potter thing because I felt like that could have been its own book. So, there's nothing.
Because every other book out now has vampires, dogs living and dead. Jessica, what else is the new?
Zombies are really the big one because there's and now it's the mashup between Jane Austen books and zombies, which is perhaps the single greatest genre ever created. There's Pride and Predator, which is coming out. The Predator alien. Ends up in the book.
Again, when you read the book, which you're all going to, obviously, DJ, the sidekick, is one of my favorite characters. His powers are...
Well, he has this strange ability to use radio waves in a variety of ways, and so one of the things he can do with radio waves is he can use the slow, rocking tunes of FM radio to lull people to sleep. And he can also harness the energy coming from AM right-wing and left-wing talk shows to zap people.
And he puts a cop to sleep with the sound of the police, which is just one of the great little things. And he actually used the Eagles a couple times to put people to sleep.
Yeah.
And I think I asked you to mix it up.
We made some changes.
Air Supply or Pure Prairie League?
It might have been Air Supply.
Air Supply, yeah. That was good. I kept track of all the groups you named. The Eagles came up 3 times. I asked you. It's hard work. I just keep track of these things.
The Steely Dan thing was really threatening to ruin our relationship because there's a lot of Steely Dan mocking in the book, and little do I know that he's a huge Steely Dan fan.
But
he took me anyway.
But I can't laugh about it. Onion last month had a big story. The headline was, Donald Fagen asked to explain Steely Dan to his friends again.
it is excellent.
It is funny.
I felt like I had to convince you. Oh, no, I really do like Steely Dan. It's fun.
The other part, when Captain Freedom has the time. Oh, did you read the part of he sorts of CDs by genre?
I didn't read that.
And I put in the margins, that's not funny, I do that. and he said, let's just move on. And don't tell anybody, which I've done 3 times now. Also, as I was about halfway in, I was starting to keep track of all the topical things you were hitting. And I sat down once with Helen, the agent, I sat down with a whole list of, like, everything, and just, did he hit them all? And you got most of them. But you didn't have a checklist in your head, did you?
I didn't. But the people ask a lot about that. They talk about how easy it is to do that. And it's, having grown up on The Simpsons, I started watching The Simpsons when it was part of the Tracy Ullman show, and everything about The Simpsons is sort of pop culture references to other things, references to past shows. They actually get to make fun of Fox. But it's The Simpsons.
Okay, so Mr. Groening, when you get that power, we'll talk.
Sounds good.
The Simpsons is amazing. Who here are Simpsons fans? Who are Simpsons fans? I watched my first episode start to finish 2 weeks ago. It was great.
When you're listening to Steely Dan LPs, it's hard to tear yourself away.
Led Zeppelin.
Okay. Right. Mm-hmm.
What, it's called irony. I'm just contrary. Anybody have any questions at this point about our artist, author, writing, musician, humorous, satirist, father, husband? Nothing else? The dedication? I love the book from the first epigram, which was, freedom is just another word for time to kick your ass. It was just, I read them going, that's very...
And there is a story behind that. When I was working on this character... I was looking to sort of celebrity autobiography, memoir kind of things to draw inspiration, and I picked up, and this was the single best thing I did, I picked up the autobiography of Pete Rose, which is impossible to read, because it's the sort of, it encapsulates the yeah, but attitude, like, yes, I'm a compulsive gambler, but I'm great. And that, you can tell he just never learns from the, yeah, but I'm great. So I drew a lot from reading about Pete Rose, and one of the things that he does in his memoir is every chapter he has a quote at the beginning of every chapter, and in one of the chapters he quotes himself. And that was just the most brazen thing I've ever seen, and I thought it was great, so I had to start the book with a quote from Captain Freedom.
Oh yeah, go ahead, yeah, we have a question.
Well, I just had to ask about the Flash Gordon reference, and what is your personal association with Flash Gordon?
That's a great question. That was outright theft from Bullwinkle. There is one brief moment, and this is one of the things that going back and watching Bullwinkle is fabulous, because it's so seditious, but they had to be so careful because of the censors. And they would toe this line, like they would talk about, oh, there's this thing about cannibalism. And Bullwinkle was complaining to Rocky that they were going to be eaten. And he's like, and Rocky said, no, they're not. We're not going to be eaten. And he said, well, how do you know? And he said, because the censors won't let them. So they handled this stuff really, really well. And at some point, he talks about the hero handbook. And Bullwinkle has the hero handbook, but he can't get past the full-page picture of Dwight Eisenhower. And I just thought that was great. So I stole it.
See, the Bullwinkle stuff I get.
Yeah.
Are you watching that with your son now, the Bullwinkle?
No, it's a little, not, you know.
Bugs
no.
Bunny?
Little Bugs Bunny, yeah. We did some Marvin the Martian the other day.
Yeah.
Thank you. And is there a graphic version in the works?
This is very graphic.
it doesn't mean explicit.
I know.
Not yet at this time.
But it's funny, when we first, in publishing, we needed a one-sentence description for the book, and I kept saying a comic novel. We both, you had to tell me, we had to stop saying that because it's satirical novel, it's because comic novel has, in this day and age, a different meaning, so.
You could have said it was a graphic novel without pictures.
I could have. with yeah. Keiko the girlfriend, modeled on anybody?
No. I don't know any assassins.
Your wife's not here. You can say.
No, really, no. Nobody.
Do you want to get into that?
Yeah, so the dedication at the beginning of the book is to my partner in crime, Blunt Girl, which is a sort of superhero name that I give Elizabeth, my wife. And I want to make sure, I want to clear things up here, that blunt refers to a manner of speaking rather than the process of hollowing out a cigar from Philadelphia and replacing the tobacco with something else. I just wanted to make that very, very clear. It was cause for concern.
Do you read a lot of comics, and have you read Brian K. Vaughan's Ex Machina? And did he steal that from you?
I have not read it.
It's about a superhero who becomes a politician, is all.
Okay.
But not as funny.
I don't, thank you. I don't read a lot of volume of comics. I used to read a ton. I would consume a ton. But there came to be a point. There were two things that happened. A, I got sort of bored with the writing, and B, I wanted to date girls. So I put comics down for a very long time. But I sort of missed this golden moment when I stopped reading comics, that this great literary form of comics, like Frank Miller, was just coming up. And Alan Moore was just starting to write these crazy things, and I missed that the first time around. But now that's really accepted. And like Joss Whedon wrote a four-part series of the X-Men, and it's fabulous. And so when I find stuff like that, I still read, but I'm very selective about it. There is one thing that's not in the book, but I've been doing running a blog, as I've said, in CaptainFreedom.net, and this is my favorite piece that's come out because it has nothing to do with the fact that he's a superhero. And it's a nice little break. It's called Why I Don't Eat Burritos Anymore. Like you, I've enjoyed burritos my entire life. They're a tasty, cheap food that you can get anywhere, even in foreign countries, like Mexico. They're compact, great on the run, and if kept in foil, they'll stay warm for some time. But I can no longer eat them. There's something about the magical combination of flour, meat, bean, lard, cheese, sour cream, and guacamole that takes out my digestive system. But it's not just the combination, it's the size. The modern burrito is too much food. Many of you are perfectly happy to consume a whole burrito and idle away the day in a Frijole-induced stupor, but not I. It's a waste of crucial metabolic processes that could be spent thinking, exercising, socializing, working, living your life. Who can say what is the cause for burrito inflation? I asked Malcolm Gladwell about it. If anyone would know about this phenomenon, it would be the man with the giant hair. Gladwell whipped off this theory about burrito size correlated to the global sex trade, and I wasn't going to buy it, except for the fact that he couched it within these delightful anecdotes about Emiliano Zapata and how he used to steal burritos from the rich during the Mexican Revolution, and how Zapata's great-great-grandcousin introduced the first mass-produced tortilla to the United States. He also spoke at length about the lost art of banana peel puppets, but I wasn't sure how it fit. I've seen people cut them in twain, but half a burrito never satisfies me. If you've left the second half for your late afternoon snack, the meat grease becomes congealed and takes on an unpalatable sheen. And let's face it, you've spent all afternoon on burrito strategy. It should be a 60% portion, which means what I've been doing is buying three burritos at a time and chopping each up to 60 and 40% portions so I can mathematically combine the 40% portions correctly for a perfect two extra 60% portions. The extra burritos are frozen, but this is suboptimal. It should be easier, but I'm no expert at burrito segmentation. Part of the problem, as always, is Mexico. Since they insist on creating tortillas a mano, there will never be universal tortilla size, and burritos will vary. There should be an ISO standard. I propose that the approximate size of a standard burrito should be equivalent in diameter to the mortar shell from a rocket-propelled grenade. That would probably cut it down to maybe 1,000 calories with sour cream and guacamole. In addition to providing a valuable standard, these rocket-propelled comestibles could be fired at terrorists and other hungry people who ate freedom. Once they've enjoyed the delicious flavor of a mission-style burrito, they'd be forced to accept peace and lay down their arms as soon as they finish digesting. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.